KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I like to read the books of my guests when they show up.
And sometimes, we're grateful. We guests are
sometimes
grateful.
Sometimes they don't read the books themselves. They haven't in a while. You may not recognize a laugh, but my guest is an old friend and an old friend of the show. This is the 20th year of the show, and it's great to have friends of the show come back. My guest is Mr. Kenneth Tran. He's a film critic of the Los Angeles Times. His book is Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. Kenny, how are you?
I am good. I'm very happy to be here, Elvis. It's always a treat to be on this program.
It's always a treat to have you here. And one of the things I found so fascinating about the book is there's an interesting concentration on comedy in it.
There are some comedies in there. I mean, it's funny because I don't necessarily think of myself as a big comedy fan.
I hadn't thought that even until I read the book, but to go from Buster Keaton to Bent Hamer, I mean, and they're all unusual takes on comedy. We can't say that many of these are conventional comedies, and you certainly can't say Sunset Boulevard's conventional comedy, but there's a lot of comedy in the book. And Kurosawa would say that in its way, the Seven Samurai is kind of a comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I get films where there are comic elements in otherwise serious films. They always take you by surprise, and that's always a treat. You know, you think you're in one kind of a film, and all of a sudden you're in something a little different, and that's always kind of exciting.
But one of the films that's not a comedy, I realize it's a movie I never talked to you about, but it's maybe one of my favorite films ever, and I think the best last final line in the history of film, which is, I was a fugitive from the Chain Gang.
Yeah.
Which has that great final exchange in it, which you go over in the book.
I mean, in terms of when I saw these films in my life, I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang is the earliest film I saw. I saw it, I was about 9 or 10 years old.
I think I was a kid when I saw it too, and it's something that's almost primal about that movie. I mean, it's as scary for me as people say Night of the Hunters for that.
Yeah, it really freaked me out. I mean, I saw it on TV in my living room at home, and it's got, I don't want to give it away because people who haven't seen it should see it, but it's got an astonishing ending. It's got a really completely amoral ending. And I'd never seen an amoral ending. I didn't know what the word meant at that time, you know, but I said, this is the end? This is what happens? I mean, I said, like, is this even legal to have a film end like this? You know, I just was really, and obviously, you know, as we both know, years later, we found out that there was something called pre-code films in Hollywood where they had these kind of amoral black themes and endings, and this was one of them. But boy, did that blow me away.
And that's that kind of sort of starkness. I mean, even the comedies you talk about have almost a kind of a stark feeling to them. I was just thinking about, again, going back to the Bent Hamer film that you have, but there's the Keaton. I mean, that's
Keaton,
an example.
Sure. Yeah.
And which Keaton do you? I'll let you give you a chance to mention this. Maybe give you a chance to read your book.
No, that I remember. See, if prompted, I remember, Elvis. I need to be prompted. But Sherlock Jr., you know, is just kind of an amazing film. And it's modern in a way that, I think will shock people who are not familiar with it. I mean, this film is like, this is nothing like the kind of Keystone Cops kind of silent films that we think define silent comedy. This is a very unusual film stylistically. It's got some wonderful touches. And you just watch it even today and you kind of just say, wow, this is really adventurous. And Keaton was a guy who really just felt he was doing a job of work. I had the real pleasure later to talk to his second wife, who was younger than he was and who survived him. And she said, you know, he was flabbergasted when these films came back, you know, when he became a celebrity again, you know, late in his life and he went to Venice.
In the 60s and 70s,
yeah,
the films had a new lease on life.
Exactly.
As you mentioned in the book, it starts off with Pauline Kael's take on Sherlock Jr.
Yeah, she was a key factor, but he just did not believe it. You know, he just didn't think of it. I mean, it's not that he didn't work hard or think they were solid pieces of work, but he thought they were disposable. He thought that once they finished playing, it was over.
Who did, of that period, who did not think that?
Well, Chaplin maybe had pretensions.
Because he was an owner.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
it was business for Chaplin.
Yeah, yeah.
But for the most part, I mean, Chaplin in that way was prescient, the way that even studio heads were not.
Yeah, he saved his stuff. He thought his stuff was important when studio heads, as you say, were tossing things out. You know, really, to this day, I think the figure, even though it's a shocking figure, something like 20% of all silent films is what survives. A lot of stuff was thrown out, was kind of junked for the silver nitrate in it.
Yeah, sure, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they thought this stuff is, who cares about this stuff? I mean, the same thing is happening, you know, to digress a little bit, with film posters, which were thrown out and nobody thought they were worth anything. And now they're worth thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Even a movie like, though, to get back to your book, which is already here, and my guess is Kenan Tran, it's the treatment. His new book is, not to be missed, 54 Film Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. I keep saying that title.
Catchy title.
Well, the film, I think, was being this way, kind of a comedy. You know, it's so odd and so dark, and it's based on a novel by somebody who I know we both like. That film is Point Blank.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that is a film, you know, against your will, against your better judgment, against everything in you. You laugh at moments in this very bleak Lee Marvin vengeance film, where Lee Marvin is like some kind of golem, you know, who strides through the film trying to get satisfaction, trying to get his money back. And, you know, it's just a lot harder than he thinks, even though no one can stand in his way. It's not like he meets anyone who's even close to being as tough as he is. But still, getting satisfaction is very difficult. And really, there are moments where he does things where you just have to laugh.
Since we're talking about this, and I know numbers mean good luck to you, why 54?
Well, 54, you know, it's an interesting question. I first thought it was a random number. I wanted something that I liked that alliterated with favorites.
And film.
So I thought something in the 50s. I also wanted a manageable number. I wanted a number that if people wanted to say, I'm going to see everything in this book, they could do it. It's not like 1,000 films to see. I wanted something that people could handle. And then I thought I picked 54. I said, I thought at random. Really, when I picked the number, I thought it was a random number. And then someone pointed out to me something, which as soon as I heard this, I knew this was the real reason I took 54. You know, in Jewish tradition, the number 18, the word chai, is the same word as the word for life. That's why you have the toast l'chaim, to life. And so when I was growing up as a kid, any multiple of 18 is considered good luck. 18, 36, 54. Cash payments for bar mitzvah boys sometimes were in multiples of 18 back in the day because it was considered good luck. And I had picked 54 for that reason, even though it had really been an unconscious choice. I didn't know that's why I done it. But once it was pointed out to me, I knew that was a reason without any doubt.
See, I thought because it was maybe some subtextual thing for you because, and we should say the book goes by eras. It starts the 20s and takes us into the 21st century.
Yeah.
But the concentration of films, the biggest number of films, comes from the 1950s.
Yeah, I know. You know, the truth is, Elvis, that totally surprised me.
You mentioned in the book.
Yeah, I picked these films one by one, and I was going to rank them just alphabetically, and my editor said, you got to do something more than that. That's not a book. So so I got the idea to rank that very simple idea, but it proved to be a potent one, to rank them by decades. And that's when I first realized that everything, a big chunk, you know, we think of the 50s as this boring decade, the 50s.
As you say, an era to be reviled.
Yeah, exactly. And all my films, most of my films, but I think the decade that has the most films.
Yeah, the 12 films from the 50s, that's more than any other decade in the book.
Is the 50s. And that really made me think, well, why was this? What did I like about those films? And I think I liked them because it was like a pivotal decade. You know, the classic Hollywood tradition that had lasted up to World War II was still in place. But World War II had shaken up not only the movie business, but the entire world. And things were changing. Things were different. And this was the decade when things started to change, when the past and the future kind of collided. And I think that's why I like those films.
But there are a number of films by foreign-born directors. Even the American, one of the American films is Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah,
And I just think so much of this for you is about people with outsider takes. I mean, even the Yiddish film you pick in the book.
Yeah. The Dybbuk is really kind of an amazing film. And it just, I mean, again, it's a film that will surprise people who think Yiddish films are all about people cracking, you know, Borscht Belt jokes, which definitely is a factor in other films. But this is a really kind of a surreal film. It's a very serious film. It's a spooky film. And, you know, it has for us the added resonance that this whole culture was wiped out. The people who made this film, didn't know that that was going to happen. They thought there'd be Yiddish films forever.
Sure.
But the Holocaust came, and it wiped out everything.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that a lot of these movies are about eras that are passing, even during the time that the films were made.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I found to be interesting, too. And I wonder if that's something that you see as kind of like a through line in things that attract you. Because I know, as am I, you're a fan of paperback novels. And so many of these things are about a time that's passing before the eyes. I mean, Seven Men from Now is about an era that's ending. And that's another 50s film.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I like, I was in college. I was a history major. The past fascinates me. And I think this kind of connection between the past and the present, when you're seeing the past go away, that is really a nice moment and something that really does seem to have a pull for me.
And that's, again, something we look at these films, that's almost, I mean, an era that's kind of ending is that era of, I mean, Fugitive from the Chain Gang, which is just before Roosevelt comes in with the New Deal and builds a social net to help save people from that.
Yeah.
But it's... And it's a movie that really was a social cry from Warner's, which was a social conscience studio at the period.
And again, you know, this notion, people forget that, you know, we think of Hollywood as this monolith that makes, you know, kind of terrible comic book movies or great comic book movies, but a lot of comic book movies. And they used to really be in the socially conscious business, you know. There's another film that didn't make it in here, it's in kind of one of the subsidiary lists.
You mean the second 54?
The second 54. You know, Wild Boys of the Road?
Yeah.
You know, which is a film about homeless kids. You know, we think we invented homeless kids, and here's a very bleak film about homeless kids.
Goes, and like so many of these films in the list, that goes from some comedy to sheer bleakness. Yeah. I mean, it kind of turns on a dime in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And Heroes for Sale is another book like that, you know, where a guy wins a medal in World War I and ends up a drug addict. You know, again, this is a major studio film. This wasn't a little Sundance film from the 30s. This was a major studio release. And we have forgotten, you know, that the studios did this kind of stuff. Obviously not anymore, but they used to do it.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess in terms of looking at this, as you were putting this list together, and one of the reasons for people to read the book is they can sort of get a sense of all this. But as you write about decade to decade, it's almost like you're surprising yourself as you're writing these essays that are introductory pieces for each of the decades in the book.
No, that's a good point. I really was surprising myself. When I broke this, simple a task as it was, when I broke these films down into decades, it really knocked me out. Because when I saw what was in each decade, when I saw which decades I liked, it really, I mean, what really amazed me was that how that simple exercise could be so revelatory for me.
I just wonder how many, as you sat down to put the list together, how many were just immediate things? Which of those were those films that just sort of came to you right away?
There were some that did, you know, but not, you know, it didn't, all 54 didn't. But the ones in the Godfather is one of my huge favorites. Children of Paradise is a major film for me. Touch of Evil, the Orson Welles film. The Earrings of Madame Duh, Max Ophuls film with just amazing camera work. Casque d'Or, another French film that I love with Simon Signoret. Some of them were like, you know, slam dunks. But they weren't all 54 slam dunks. Some of it was kind of, what should I do here? It was tricky.
And again, because you hadn't imposed this order on the book, it really came to you organically, didn't it?
Exactly, exactly. I made big lists. I looked at other people's lists. I looked at lists from like film magazines of the greatest films. I kind of racked my brains. I made big, big lists of hundreds of films. And then I'd go through it when I was ready to write, you know, when I'd finish a piece. And then I would say, okay, what should I do next? And I'd go through the list and I'd say, okay, I feel like this one. And I'd see it again and I'd write about it. And then, you know, so the list kind of, it really did grow organically. And near the end, you know, it got really heartbreaking because I really felt these films were like, you know, calling out to me, you know, saying, Ken, don't leave me behind. Put me in the book. You know you love me, you know. And I couldn't fit them all in. I mean, that's why, as you say, I had all these extra lists. I've got a second 54. I've got all kinds of stuff I do. Because the real reason for this film's existence is that I want people to enjoy these films the way I do. I want them to have fun with these movies, and I want people to know about them. You know, because you do the same thing, to devote a big chunk of your life to film is the only way to know about films. And people who don't have the time for that, I want them to be able to have the benefits.
We're going to take a break. My guest is NPR film critic Kenny Turan. He's also a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. His book, which apparently I've read, is not to be missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about a book that you should maybe read, and so you can tell its author all about it. The book is not to be missed. 54 Favorites from a Lifetime, film by our old friend Kenny Turan. Kenny Turan, film critic of the LA Times. And what was really kind of fun for me, too, is just being reminded, as you remind people, or it'll be new information for a lot of folks, of the world that existed for movies before the 21st century, where, as you mentioned, something I didn't have in Detroit, but I'd heard about it, the idea of the million-dollar movie, film would play, four or five times during the week,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. They had us, obviously a deal to show us, from a certain studio, old movies, and they played them four or five times a week, and sometimes people, I'd hear that people would, fall asleep during one screening and catch up to the second half of the film a couple of nights later. And, I was a kid in New York, and I had a TV set, and my parents, there were no parental controls in those days. There was nothing on TV for people to worry about. So I would watch these movies on TV, and I got to really like them. And I watched them all by myself. My parents were busy, and I'd sit in the living room with a little TV and watch the movies, and they were amazing.
I wanted to get back a little bit to the 50s here, because, again, that's the era, that's the period of Touch of Evil. It's also the period of All About Eve. I mean, there are, and I think people, even a lot of film people, when they're talking about the 50s in the abstract, they will run it down. And once you start to name movies that come from the 50s, and you go from the American films to the Seven Samurai to French films, it becomes a period where each year of that decade, there's somebody, at least one really smart filmmaker. And a lot of these films from the 50s, you pick up by writer-directors as well, which I think is really, because that's also about a shift in filmmaking at that point, isn't it?
And obviously they made some bad films in the 50s. It's not
they made a whole bunch of them. Yes.
But, I mean, we forget that these good films really were there. And, they really, I mean, again, the studio system was crumbling. The individual writer-directors were having more power. And it turns out it was a decade with some really good films in it. And All About Eve is just a phenomenally good film.
Yeah, but I guess it was interesting, too, because I thought you ended up picking more movies from the 21st century than I expected.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, but there's some that I really loved. I mean, when we talk about bleak comedies, the last film in the book in terms of chronology is an Israeli film called Footnote, which is just a kind of an astonishing story. It's set in Hebrew University in the Department of Talmudic Studies. Not, you would think, an ideal place for a black comedy. But then there's about these two Talmudists who come from different ends of the spectrum and hate each other's guts, and they turn out to be father and son. And this is the premise of the film. And boy, there's some great stuff in there.
Yeah, but again, that sense of that through line that you don't really know in the book, but it occurred to me that so many of these are movies that just kind of spin on a dime, that they're one thing, and in the middle of a scene becomes something else.
Yeah, this film especially, I mean, all of a sudden it gets to be really, there's really almost a scene you can really you point to. I won't mention it because, again, I want people to see the film, but there's a scene where everything changes. You say, oh, my God. This is really not the kind of film I thought.
And in the middle of the scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I was thinking about that. And that's why in so many of these films, though, there is that. And the thing that comes out as often as not is that what you love about movies and still love is the prospect of being surprised by that.
Oh, yeah. No, really. I mean, I still, every time I'm in a screening, which is often, really, it's like a mantra I say to myself. The lights start to go down. You know what it's like. The lights start to go down. I really say to myself, I hope this one is good. I hope this one is good. And, it happens, And sometimes you have to wade through a lot of nonsense, but eventually you hit this film where you say, boy, this guy knows what he's doing, or this woman knows what she's doing. And it really, these films are really, they're good. You get, that's what keeps you going in this job, is the excitement you get when you see something new that's good. Really panning films gets old, You have to do it, but it's not really sustaining.
It's not really, it's not the fun that people think that
no,
is.
No, it really isn't. I mean, I think it was more fun when I was, in my 20s, it was more fun. At this point in time, it's not so much fun. But discovering new films that are exciting, that you can tell people about, that they're going to like, that's still very much alive.
And as I was reading this book, I was reminded of one of the last times you were here was you came to talk about the film festival book, and that same undercurrent. I connected the two books. That book was about going around the world and finding surprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not only being surprised about the films, but about the cultures that you were being exposed to through these films. And for you, it almost becomes this kind of cultural anthropology, doesn't it? Where when you're surprised by something, it makes you rethink your own reaction to the world, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's also the great thing about film, especially in this day and age where films from every country make their way to the United States.
Finally, yes.
You know, which didn't used to be that way. But, you know, you really, if you see a country's films, you get an insight into their culture. It's not like you become an expert, but you have a window. You have an insight. You have an idea of what it's like to see the world from a different point of view. And that's wonderful. I mean, that's a wonderful thing to realize that and to be able to do that, to access other countries' consciousness, even to a limited extent that film lets you do.
When you went to Africa and you wrote about that festival, and I just remember sitting and talking to you about it, and you just... what it took to get there. I mean, literally, the physical effort it took to get there. And then still being just sort of exhilarated by the prospect once you were there, which even surprised you after that trip.
Yeah. And also, it's just great to see how all over the world people love films and people want to see themselves on film. You know, and this is a key thing. And I, you know, really at FESPACO, you know, in Burkina Faso, that's one of the places that became really clear to me that everyone wants and deserves to see themselves on film. It's very satisfying, it's nourishing, and everyone deserves it.
And it's to my regret, I still haven't a chance to go to FESPACO yet. I want to go.
Yeah,
I
was going
to
go. You almost went. You got close.
Yeah, yeah. And then we were warned not to go by the U.S. government to go to that part of the world. But it's still my goal to get there.
You should go. No, it's really it's an enriching place to go. It really is.
But I told you when you're here and we talk about the book, it reminded me of my first time not going to Sundance, but going to Cannes, which I didn't know what to expect. And it was kind of an incredible year. It was 2000, so it was a year of In the Mood for Love, and a movie I know you went so crazy about, Amoros Perros, but George Washington. And I just thought, is it like this all the time? You went, oh, no.
No, there are good years. No. There's some years where you say, wow, now this is why I'm here. And there's some years where you say, well, this is okay, but...
Well, my guest, who still loves to be surprised by movies, and I was surprised that I read his book, is Kenneth Turan. The book is Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. But because as I was reading the book, I wondered, as you were putting the list together, if it surprised you that there were films that didn't make the first cut or directors that didn't make the cut. Because I want people to pick the book up and be surprised by who's not in it. But there are some filmmakers I thought for sure that would make the cut who did not.
Well, you know what surprised me the most? And I think there is one film I could put in the book, you know, if I get to do another version. The film I felt bad that I still not even quite sure why I left it out is Lawrence of Arabia. Because it's a type of filmmaking that really I don't think we'll ever see again. You know, this type of big, big, big budget, intelligent, literate films intended for adults. I don't think those are coming back. I mean.
Well, no, I mean, and the idea of a movie based on the seven pillars of wisdom. if there's ever a book that would qualify, and this is a word I use advisedly, as unreadable, it is the seven pillars of wisdom.
Yeah.
And it's really not the book anyway. I mean.
And, you know, it just was just, I don't know, it just was like, you know. Great films are magic, you know, they just happen. Something happens and, you know, Peter O'Toole, David Lean, you know, Lawrence, even though he was, you know, an unusual guy, certainly lived a very dramatic life. And his story is quite something. And this film, you know, I can still see some of those scenes, you know, in the desert. And for some reason, it didn't make it.
But, you know, it's interesting that the films, there's not really a film in this book that I would call an epic film. I mean, they're all fairly... intimate movies. And I feel like as you're talking about Lawrence of Arabia, the sheer size of it doesn't allow itself to be a part of this. I mean, I can't think of a film, even Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is not a film that I would call epic in filmmaking scale. And it feels like the films that you're dealing with, and it's almost probably 2/3 of the cases are films with writer-directors attached as well. And that's just a kind of movie that almost needs to be included in another kind of book.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I mean, really for me, and again, you know, writing this book was in some ways, I mean, I learned things about myself, you know, because these choices are so personal, you know, and I really, and again, or maybe learned is too strong a word, but it emphasized to me things that I knew in the back of my mind. The human connection is very important to me in films, films about people, films about human interaction. That's the kind of stuff I really connect to. And that's a real through line in the book, as you say.
Yeah, and that sort of sense of intimacy, because probably my favorite of the renowned films of those 50s Paramount Westerns is Seven Men from Hell.
No, that's a great film. You know, and I love the idea that, you know, one of the fun things about doing this book is that I went to the Academy Library here in Los Angeles, which is an amazing place to do research.
And it's a great place to spend time because you don't get, there's almost never anybody in there.
No. So I hate to even mention it because I don't want it to get too crowded, you know. But, you know, Seven Men from Now, that was written, someone came up with the title and they said, here's the title, write the movie. You know, I was like, how could something good come from that? But an amazing film came out of that.
And tell, for the audience who don't know those Randolph Scott films, tell them.
Yeah, there's a whole series of films, as you say. They're called the Renowned Series because of the name of the production company. Randolph Scott was the star. Bud Bedeker was the director. And they're lean, economical Westerns. A lot of them are 70 minutes long.
They're basically Western noir.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it. And they're just wonderful films. Randolph Scott was just perfect for them. And, you know, he got the role by accident because John Wayne wanted to do him a favor. You know, it was not like someone had this idea to do something great. And they turned out to be remarkable. I showed one at the Archery Museum recently. And
which one did you show?
It. I showed Seven Men from Now.
Okay.
And people, you know, again, the whole point of this book is that there's stuff out there that people will like, not that they ought to like or that it would be good for them or that they're classics. They're going to enjoy the hell out of it.
Because that's one of the things I find really fascinating about the book. You eschew the word classic in it. Yeah. You don't use it.
It's in this book is the stuff I like. And some of them are, you know, some of them could be called classics.
I'm just saying, the films we've all mentioned here could be on any reasonable person's list be called classic. But you make a point of not using that word.
Yeah, I like them. I just like them. That's the key word for me is enjoyment.
I think you love them.
I love them. I won't hide from that.
This is public radio. I know you're not allowed to use words that big here, but it's you can say that. This is a craft of the writer, but not making certain word choices, it makes it a much more personal relationship. If you don't use words like the great or classic, or any of those kinds of things, but describe the movie in the terms of the way that they had an impact on you.
Yeah.
I just felt like it's kind of a refreshing kind of form of film criticism to write about things that have a life in your heart that don't have anything else tied to them other than your own feelings about them.
That was the connection. You know, some of them everyone knows, some of them no one knows. You know, there's some very obscure films here, not intentionally, but I just happened to see them and I fell in love with them.
Oh, Castor is a movie that almost nobody talks about.
Castor is a great film.
Which I thought, oh my God, I can't remember the last time. And as I read it more, I thought, I don't think I've ever actually spoken about this movie to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of in France, it's much better known because it's Simone Signoret and, you know, and Jacques Becker. But I mean, these films really, really, really speak to me. You know, and they speak to other people, too. I mean, I just had the occasion. I had some friends over a little movie
club. So somebody else read the book.
Yeah. Okay. No, I hadn't read the book. I said I hadn't read the book. But I had to pick a film to show them, and I picked Castor, and it just blew people away. I mean, people think that any film this good they would have heard of. And it's just the world doesn't work that way. There are too many films out there.
That's true. And we're out of time. And my guest, these things always go so fast. Yeah, I guess you got to write more books because you clearly don't have anything else you're doing. The book is now out in paperback.
Yes.
It is by Kenneth Turand. I will do this again from memory. Not to be missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. Kenny, it's always a pleasure having you. Thanks so much.
The pleasure is mine, Elvis. This is a real treat. Thank you.
And I bought the book again on Kindle, just so you know. So I have somewhere there's a cover, the hardcover, sitting in a store, along with
your name on it.
Yes, with your name on it. I didn't write the book. Patrick Murray's our engineer in NPR West. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm going to go see the 55th movie. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.